Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of July 31st, 2016. This is Jack Bressett-Mills. Conversation today with Laura, part one of that first verses I wrote for Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul for his week 18. This one I wrote 2 years ago. Verse 18. I wish to weave a soul worthy of the spirit and open it somehow so wide it will embrace the Logos and I'll feel it moving in my inmost core. And this one I wrote for the same Rudolf Steiner verse last year, verse 18a. I feel the clearest need to become inwardly strong, able to contain a soul worthy of the spirit, wide enough and supple enough to expand, to grow as to hold the universe within the seed of my heart. Oh, Laura, I'm so lucky to have so many young friends since I taught years ago. And I taught Laura a little bit. Thank you, Laura, for speaking. Here you go. Hey, Laura.
Hey there, how are you?
Thanks for doing this.
Sure, you're welcome. Looking forward to it.
The one thing I wanted to ask you, I don't know if it affects me when I see the photo. You had been somewhere, maybe it was in Africa, and it seemed like blue was the dominant color of every building, or at least part of every building had this blue glass color. Reminded me of Northern Africa somewhere, Morocco, I don't know what.
You know, there's an interesting story about that. It's a city in northern Morocco called Chefchaouen.
Okay.
Malaria had swept through the city and killed a lot of people, except this one Jewish family, and they painted their house blue, and it was the only house in the city that was blue. And the king of Morocco said, wow, you know, this guy has really got something going on, and he said, let's paint the whole city blue, and that's what they did. And so
marvelous.
There's no mosquitoes in the city now, and there's a tradition every year the women go out and paint the city, not the men. The men do the house chores for the day, and then paint.
Yeah, that's cool. So you were in Morocco.
I was. I was there in 2010 and 11 for a year on a State Department scholarship to learn Arabic, and then I recently returned at the beginning of this year for an internship.
Very cool. I had a Learn in Your Car Arabic tape, and there was like 3 or 4 hours of introductory sounds with the throat alone. It was just different ways of going, and it's very hard to start such a thing. I don't know how you get into it, but if you're living there, that's very. I think it's much easier. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to be committed, because those sounds are just very foreign to everything I've ever learned. You've got the qaf in your lower throat, and then the ayin, which is the hardest. It's like and I don't even know how to describe how you do that one, but living there definitely helped with learning the sounds.
So, State Department, cool. What were you wanting to talk about today? Anything in particular?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts going on in my head.
I can't help it myself. This whole world scene, it seems like this year, even more than last year, even more than the year before, it's just a crazy world. What a world.
I know, right? I recently did a news fast, which was just wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I want to do it all the time now.
It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. The whole world around where you are is fine. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
The world sucks when you listen to the news, but wherever you are, it seems like it's reasonable and people are nice.
Yeah, no kidding.
So.
Yeah, I went up to New Mexico. I don't know if you know the Llama Foundation.
No.
Well, it's a spiritual place up in the mountains. It's all self-sustainable and green. And there is electricity, but it's all solar. And people can go there for retreats, or they can do summer stewardships, or go up and live there for however long and just kind of bliss out in the nature. And that was wonderful. And it was sort of like a centering prayer meditation retreat that I did. And I've been thinking a lot about that and how it's just really been an awakening experience.
Yeah, I think it does. For me, I've always used it as my fallback that what am I doing with my life? Well, I'm meditating. And if anyone can point to something and say, that's my most important thing and I am doing it regularly, you can kind of say, well, the rest is secondary. As long as I'm doing the thing I have declared to be my most important thing, in a way, I've used it in a way to not have to be a doctor and not have to save the world. I can focus on the thing that I say is my most important thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, taking care of yourself is just the most important thing. Yourself and your immediate surrounding community.
Yep.
Because you can't fix the suffering that you see in the news. And I mean, you can't do it directly. You can do your small part at home.
Yeah. I feel that with the plants. Just now I came in from outside and Barbara said, oh, look what you've got. And she was talking about something on my back. And it was a big old katydid, if you know what a katydid is. It's a very, It's like a double-sized grasshopper. But they make a lot of noise at night. They go ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch all night long. Anyway, it was on my back. And so she got it off into a cup and I carried it out and let him get onto a plant so he wouldn't get eaten by a bird right away. Just the different effect you could have in your environment. I said hello to this tree today that I've overlooked for 15 years, but I've parked under it every day for the last 15 years. And so today I said, you know, this tree has been a good friend. I've been parking under him for 15 years. That kind of thing. I believe that you can really affect the earth in your own little area.
Absolutely.
And I suppose that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even I have, with the new age of technology, I have a lot of my close friends who are abroad. And one of my friends, she recently went back to Yemen, and she's really experiencing a lot of suffering and war. And I can't help her, but directly, you know, I can't fix the problem, but by talking to her and listening and, you know, sending her money if she needs money, that is something little that I feel I can help from my small community here. But
and the idea that someone somewhere cares for me, I mean, she knows that now. She can tell someone somewhere cares for me. That means a great deal.
Oh, absolutely.
Just a single person cares for me.
Yeah, love across borders, and that's what's important, is just developing connection. And what I've learned in my time abroad is just, you know, when you meet someone personally, it's a completely different experience than what you might experience, you know, on the news or in the media. And it breaks down stereotypes, and you know, if you can break away language barriers, you just get to this point with the other person where it's just your true selves interacting with each other. And you lose that sense of false identity or your ego. And especially for my friend in Yemen, because she's really facing a lot of hardship, and I find that because she's in such a traumatic situation, she is forcing herself to focus on what is important. And the way she interacts with me is just pure love, you know, and what a lesson and a blessing that is.
Yeah. You made me think of this eye contact business. I've always had success if I'm ever confronted by violent people. I look into their eyes, and I have not been hurt, and I've passed through the danger with weaker companions. My wife and I together, we often would go walking in New York at any time of day or night, and So sometimes people would stand up and confront us. Are we the people to rob next? You know, totally. I totally understood the situation, but by looking in their eyes, they say, yeah, let them go. They're okay. And I'm told that some cultures, you're not supposed to look into people's eyes. And even in some trains, it says illegal to make eye contact. Maybe that's even in New York. Subways have that warning, illegal really? To make eye contact. And so it takes away my whole idea that I can always diffuse a tense situation by showing them who I am and looking into their eyes. But you would know better than me. Are there cultures that you actually can't do that? It's not allowed to do that. It means something else. Like if you look at a grizzly bear in the eyes, it means something and he's going to come after you. That's what they say anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true with humans at all in some cultures.
Well, that's interesting. I know that it's true in the Gulf countries, especially between men and women. I don't know about women and women or men and men. I imagine that it's fine and respectful. It was funny, in the subways in Korea, I would get these silly looks from Koreans. They would look in my eyes, and then once I would return the gaze, they would immediately look down. But I think that was more of embarrassment. But I do agree that once you make eye contact, it just changes the whole moment and the relationship, the connection.
This man, Rudolf Steiner, that you heard of, he proclaimed that there were 12 senses, and one of the highest of the 12, of course, sense of touch and taste were all in there, but there are others, like, for example, balance, and like, for example, health. You can tell when something is healthy or not healthy. But he had this, one of the higher ones was the sense of ego, that you can see when you're looking at an ego. It's a completely different sensation to be looking at something else besides an ego. So for me, looking in the eyes, I can see if there's a person in there and what they're made of. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's the sense of ego.
Yeah. Well, what was just so eye-opening from this experience at Lama was, after, you know, meditating for hours every day, you just get to this point where you can't walk through life with your ego and your false facade. It's literally just stripped down to where it's your true self. And you know, there's no sense of materialism or greed. And I think that's just such an interesting concept. And why do we keep wearing this facade of falseness? Maybe it's just a dissatisfaction. I mean, I think it goes all the way back to, with greed especially, I mean, throughout history, like the gold rush, for example, people would come over to the U.S., Europeans, and they discovered gold, and it would just become an obsession. And I think it was a reaction to the sense of individualism and separateness. I think everyone just has this chattering in their minds and this psychological discord that produces negative thoughts. And I think there's a strong sense of isolation and this separation throughout my travels. I've definitely experienced this separation of us and them. And that stems from fear and the unknown. And then once you break that away, you realize what you have in common. And I think it's especially interesting when you're traveling, and I mean, you really just don't have much in common with maybe someone sitting next to you in the train. But once you can break away that false facade, and I think there's many ways to do it. For, you know, meditation is one. You can develop a meditation practice. And then another, which is another thought that I've kind of been thinking about, is after 9/11, or do you remember how everyone just came together? And
very much so.
Yeah, and the rate of violence just plummeted. You know, it was...
Definitely, yep.
Yeah, it was...
One of the great, great tragedies of our lifetime is that we lost that as a country. We had this chance to really, right. to really lead. You really have a chance when you've been hit, when it's your turn to hit back. If you don't hit back, that's your chance, is to say, okay, now let's not continue this violence.
Right.
But if you've been, if you just beat someone up, that's not your chance any longer to say, okay, now let's stop this violence. You just beat somebody up. You have no right to stop the violence. They now have the choice to continue or not, but not you. You don't have the choice.
Yeah.
Anyway. Say this, what you say, how long does it last is one question after the meditating, unless you keep the meditating up, of course, then it mm-hmm. can last. I've always related that to an idea of immortality or mortality, that people who've gone through an accident where they nearly died or they've been diagnosed with cancer and they've nearly died, that kind of person has also lost this covering. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have time anymore for greed and jealousy. And so I think there's many ways of taking that cloak off, to be yourself, to be naked in a way in public, and be able to be naked without the shame that most people have.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent point. I just went to hear this one author, journalist, his name is Sebastian Junger, and he brought up a similar point about this woman who had cancer, and she recovered and she survived. And years later, she expressed that she almost wanted the cancer back again because it brought her family together. And it gave her, yeah, like you said, she just lost that covering and false self. And
yeah,
I thought that was really fascinating.
I imagine that's the draw of performing, maybe on stage or singing, that you are naked and there becomes a feeling of release. I do it through writing. I write everything about myself and I put it out there. And in a way, it's kind of a habit after a while. Then you like being naked then in public. And yeah. It's a real free thing then, and I want to keep it up. And whether it's through meditation or whatever, it's such a wonderful feeling that you don't have to be hiding behind this cloak of shame any longer.
Yeah, cloak of society.
Yeah, cloak of society.
Expectations.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't quite know how it happens with meditating, if maybe in the particular group you're with or that the teacher you have, it could be much more, I can imagine a meditation leading you toward more egotism, if you did it. I mean, the you've heard this phrase, navel gazing, and that's a derogatory term for meditation. And I think the reality of that is that it's possible, I think, to become more egotistical by taking on a spiritual path. But you found a way to do it where there's less egotism, it sounds like, and more openness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm just in the beginning of my spiritual journey.
Yeah.
But, yeah, absolutely. I can see how once you get to a certain point in your spiritual journey that the ego would maybe somehow creep its way back in.
Yeah. Of course, it's never not there. We are egos. And
mm-hmm.
I was always taught that you, for example, if you're a student, that's a very egotistical thing to be because you believe you deserve to learn. And being a teacher, what an egotistical thing to be, that you think you know something to teach. And the way to go about it is not to avoid the ego, but to say yes, and then to go past it somehow, to say, yes, I am an ego, I have egotism, and yet I will learn, yet I will drop it, I will lay it aside. Somehow that you are consciously being the ego and going beyond it. I like that idea, that you're not getting rid of it somehow. It's always with us.
Oh, yeah, and you should love it and accept it and be non-critical towards it, which is the hardest part,
I guess. I mean, it is. They used to say, apparently, genius used to be something on the outside of us that would visit us and the artist would hope to entice the genius to come and to visit them. And then when they wrote the great poem or symphony, they felt that the genius had blessed them. It was never that a person was a genius. That's a modern idea, I think. I like that older idea better, that it's a grace. It's a visiting of grace upon us, in a way.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
I'll stop that there, and about that much left for next week. Please send me a comment if you like at jackmills@mac.com or at my website, reasoningwithanoptimist.net. And I'll hope to see you again next week. Jack Brissett Mills. Bye-bye.